and welcome to the Metal Hammer podcast, episode 183. My name's Eleanor, I'm deputy editor at Metal Hammer, and I'm here with Jonathan, our reviews editor. How are you doing, Jonathan?
I'm doing very well, very excited, because after about 2 years of lockdown and general pining, I'm finally back off to Norway tomorrow.
Yeah, nature is healing.
It is.
For anyone who doesn't know, Norway is Jonathan's second home, isn't it?
My second and my spiritual home, and also the home of salt scum licorice, which is I'll be bringing back in vast numbers and terrorising everyone around me with.
It's basically disgusting, but we all love you, so we'll let you have it.
Thank you.
I'm also here with the wonderful Steve, Metal Hammer contributor. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm all right, thanks. I'm okay. I'm scared that I might get offered one of those sweets that Jonathan is bringing back from Norway, because I've got to be honest, I've put some pretty rank things in my mouth before, but they're right up there. They are right up there, those things. He's shaking his head ruefully. I don't know what you get out of that, Jonathan. Just because it's from Norway. It's not everything from Norway is brilliant. Those sweets are rank, mate. Horrible. Oh, dear.
No, well, once you have that kind of really salty licorice, it's just like there's no going back, sorry.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, you know. There's definitely no going back.
Well, before we get stuck into your questions, let me just remind you that the new issue of Metal Hammer is on sale now. It is a massive tribute to the one and only Jerry Jordison, written by the fantastic writer Paul Branigan. It includes anecdotes from many of his friends, many of the musicians who knew him. There's also a 10-page Bloodstock review, and we also go inside Metallica's Blacklist album, speaking to many of the artists featured on it. I also have to give a shout out to our amazing sponsors, Killstar. They have a range of amazing clothes and accessories and homewares on their website. Whether you like goth, rock, punk, it's all there. There's so many things you can get. There's an amazing collection called Midwinter, perfect for Halloween. You can check out all their stuff at tinyurl.com/killstarhammer. That's tinyurl.com/killstarhammer. Okay, guys, are we ready to jump into the reader questions?
Yes, very much so.
Some of them are going to be very hard, I reckon, so I'm curious to see what you guys are going to come up with. So, question number one. This is from Matt Grimster. He says, any thoughts on the return of Nevermind the Buzzcocks? The early series had the likes of Bruce Dickinson, Lemmy, and Dave Mustaine as guests, but sadly, the chances of Rock of Metal getting any mention there nowadays are pretty low. So, has anyone seen it, first of all? Jonathan, have you seen the new Nevermind the Buzzcocks?
I have not. I think just, you know, I'm getting to that point where the older I get, in inverse proportion, or in proportion, everything in modern life gets more shit. And I feel more disenfranchised from pop. We know, whereas I grew up like a complete 80s kid when you had amazing, spectacular pop stars. So I don't really know who's going to be on it, and I don't know who are the big personalities these days. And I just always found Nevermind the Buzzcocks a little bit scripted.
Controversial.
Yeah, it was a little bit too scripted. They had a few people who refused to do any scripts, and that was great, but... not the world's biggest fan, but I do like it when they did have kind of metal bands like Cradle of Filth and Mistress on it every now and again.
Yeah, well, that is exactly what Matt Grimster is saying, that it used to be a little bit more alt, a little bit more controversial. This new series, the presenters are Jamali Maddox, Daisy May Cooper, Greg Davis and Noel Fielding. They're the team captains, and then obviously they have different guests on each week. Steve, have you seen it?
I've seen a clip of it. I've seen Jade from Little Mix slam dunking Noel Gallagher, and I like that very much, because she said Noel Gallagher had a pop at Little Mix, and she said we're the most successful girl band in the country, and he's not even the most successful person in his family, and everyone, oh, sick burn, etc, etc. I think Greg Davis is really funny.
Yeah,
he's really funny. I quite like that Jamali Maddox guy. I'm not really familiar with the other person you said. Hannah Mae Cooper, was that who you said it was?
No, she's
Joel Dommett's wife.
Metal Hammer's writers. I said Daisy Mae Cooper.
Daisy Mae Cooper. No, and that's not one of Metal Hammer's writers either. That's Hannah Mae Kilroy, you're thinking.
Oh,
of.
Yeah, you were crossing the two.
I was, yeah. Anyway. No, actually, I think that's my friend's wife, actually. So...
Come on now, Steve.
Anyway, it is. I haven't seen it yet. I'm not that fussed by it, really. I thought the original Nevermind the Buzzcocks peaked when Simon Amstell was on it. And Simon Amstell, like you said, Jonathan, it was quite scripted. But Simon Amstell did some... He brought some of that weird...
Yeah, I love Simon Amstell. I used to love Pop World.
Yeah, he brought some of that Pop World kind of surrealist humour to Nevermind the Buzzcocks. And it was really funny. But when they started just... I don't know, getting people like Rizzlekicks hosting it, I was a bit like, I'm not so sure. So I can't say I'm particularly excited about a new Nevermind the Buzzcocks. And yeah, I would say the likelihood of them mentioning metal or rock in any way, slim to none, really, isn't it? Slim to none.
The world has changed so much. But on that note, though, we do have, in a few weeks' time, we have another issue coming, which has got an interview in it, which mentions Danny Filth's appearance on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and it's pretty colourful, so have a look out for that when it comes in a few weeks' time.
Can I just say as well, Dave Mustaine did not go on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, as Matt has said here. He didn't, did he? Surely. I've never seen that. I've seen Lemmy and Bruce Dickinson. Dave Mustaine didn't go on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. We'd all have seen that, right? I've never seen that.
I was taking Matt's word for it. Are you calling him a bad researcher? We should have researched it, shouldn't we?
I'm saying I don't remember that. And I just think that would be a thing that everyone would now talk about, right? And remember.
Let's have a look after this and see if we can see anything. I have to save that for another time. But
yeah, okay.
I would love to see some metal on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. It would be amazing. You know, going back to those days of like TFI Friday when you get people on there, like there was just a different era of TV, wasn't there, that has kind of gone by. Let's bring it back.
It's just about how, how sort of, you know, metal and hard rock has kind of fallen out of the cultural discourse of late. You know, that's kind of a bit much more of a wider thing. Like you never get like,
well,
problems. Go on.
Well, I was going to say it's because bands like Spirit Box and Sleep Token are the ones that are getting in the charts and they're boring, and I wouldn't want to see them on telly
over
Steve. Little Mix.
Right.
To be honest,
I think we should wind up this discussion and move on to the next question. The next question is a bit less taxing as well. Jonathan, do you want to take it?
Yeah, so Ewan Taylor asks, what are the most metal breeds of dog? Now, I find this quite taxing because I'm a cat person and I don't really know much about dogs other than they yap a lot and bark a lot and take a lot of care. And are very needy.
And eat toddlers' faces as well. People who
what? What are you talking about?
Well, they do, don't they? More than cats. Let's be honest. They do more than cats.
I mean, dogs are more emo than metal because they're so needy.
Mm. Oh, okay then, Jonathan. Do you favourite cat?
Cats are pretty metal. You've not seen the thing on Twitter, the Black Metal Cats.
Yes. What an amazing account. If you're not following that, go over and follow Black Metal Cats. It's incredible. They just have a picture of a really metal cat with a caption about the cat being really metal.
It's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming from the hardcore scene, I would say surely the Rottweiler, due to his work alongside bands like Terror and Madball, I think you have to like chuck him in there as a mention. And that whole vocal style being that like oh thing, that's pretty dog-like. So I would say there's a link to kind of New York hardcore in the Rottweiler and Staffordshire Bull Terrier era and area of the canine world, I would say.
Oh, interesting. That's actually like a proper bit of criticism about the role of the dog there, Steve.
Well, you can get Terror branded dog collars. So
wow.
They know, you know, that they're part of it. They've all got like Staffies and Rottweilers and stuff, haven't they? All those hardcore lads.
Yeah. I haven't really picked a breed. I've just picked my friend's dog. He's called Eddie and is named after Eddie from Iron Maiden and is a border collie and he's so cute and he's just got this tongue that like flops out the side of his mouth and he's got these little ears that are all kind of like they're meant to be pricking up but they're not, they're kind of like curled down and he's like the sweetest, most good-natured dog and you know, being kind and caring can be metal too, so I think Eddie is a pretty metal dog.
Cats are more metal. They're not kind nor caring.
Anyway. My cat's quite kind and caring. She's been very sweet. I've been ill this week and she's been really sweet.
Sorry, Ewan, for that answer to your question. You're probably hoping for a lot more different breeds there. We've all given our own answers in our own ways. Mark Baker asks, seeing how easy it is to get the public to panic buy, what 2021 album will you leak to the media as, quotation marks, there is a shortage of, in order to induce the panic buying of? So basically, which album would we tell people to go out and buy? I think is what I was asking.
Well, to create a shortage of.
I think,
so
yeah,
is that a different sort of, because are you going, you need to go out and buy this because you need it, or do you need to create a shortage of it to kind of eradicate it from the general consciousness?
No, I think that's going too far. I think he just right. went like, which, I think it basically means, which album would you tell everyone to go out and buy, doesn't it? Which album yeah. will you tell there's a shortage, if you went to the papers and said there's a shortage of this to get people to buy it? Like, this is easy for me, Steve, and I know you said earlier, you said something not very nice about Spirit Box, but mm-hmm. I think they're amazing. I love their record Eternal Blue. It's just gone top 20 in the UK and the US. And I'd get people to panic buy that to get it to number one, because I think it deserves a number one. Although top 20 is amazing for a debut album from a metal band, so big congrats to them.
Yeah, see, especially one with no personality at all. But
Steve!
Yeah, go on.
See, I'm trying to work out the logistics of this, because there's streaming. You know, there's not going to be a shortage of, you know, unless there's a shortage of streams. I'd say Led Zeppelin 2, because it's got a whole lot of love. And so you can just say, we're running out of love, so quickly buy this record, because we're going to run out of love really soon.
That's such an abstract answer, Jonathan.
But they've got a whole lot of love, Jonathan. So you can't have... You have to buy
that was a whole...
If you start with a whole lot of love...
Yeah, but
it's going to take ages to run out, surely.
No, but there was a whole lot of petrol. There was a whole lot of carrots in Sainsbury's.
Whole lot of toilet roll.
Yeah, a whole lot of toilet roll.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of everything that's running out.
Imagine if Robert Plant had gone, written the lyrics to that song. You know, you got that riff. Written whole lot of toilet roll. What do you think Jimmy Page and John Bonham and John Paul Jones would have said? Can we just change the toilet roll? I don't know, it just doesn't feel quite right, the whole lot of toilet roll, Robert.
Yeah, they'd be ahead of their time.
Yeah.
But you know, all the distribution networks are going down because they can't find people to distribute the records, along with the oil and the carrots. So,
wow.
There are some actual problems with shortages that are having an impact on the music industry. But I think this is meant to be a more lighthearted question, so we don't need to worry about logistics.
Fine.
I think we should take this question seriously.
I would like to pick an album that there already is, in my mind, a shortage of. So Fantastic Planet by Failure, which came out in 1996, and you got to pay a lot of money to get that record. It's a fucking brilliant record, and I would suggest, if you can get your hands on that record, I would suggest you buy it, because we do have a current shortage of the first Manual Surrender album, which is brilliant. On the Turn by Curve Dog, you can't get that anymore. Can't get Jupiter by Cave-In on vinyl.
What?
It's almost impossible to get
outrageous.
That fucking record on vinyl. There is a legitimate global shortage of these records. I don't have to pretend at all. We do. I would panic buy 30, 40 copies of Fantastic Planet by Failure just to make sure that I had enough in supply.
So basically,
very short.
So basically, yeah. Record store day is everyone panic buying because there's a shortage of those
records.
It
is, yeah. Hmm. It is actually, isn't it? Like, I've actually never done the thing where you queue.
It's induced panic buying. Yeah, it's induced panic buying.
It is.
I would like to get, Through Silver and Blood by Neurosis, getting that on vinyl is impossible. So that's been panic bought to shit, because if you can get your hands on it, you fucking get your hands on it. I nearly paid 600 quid for it, and then I was like, what am I doing? I put it in my basket and everything, and I was like, I can't justify this, but I do want it. So
I did spend 100 quid in an EP a few years back.
What EP was it?
It was the Electric Wizard Reverend Bizarre Split, but the uncensored one with the 70s kind of porn on it.
Well, I can that feels like justifiable to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like super rare. There's a version with a star over the pubic area, and there's a much rarer version without. I had a friend who was in LA and phoned me up outside this record shop saying, "Do you want this? Because I'll buy it now." And I was like, "Yeah," and proudly own it.
I wish I had friends like yours, Jonathan.
I mean, people can exploit... Like, Glassjaw have just re-released their first two albums again in a bloody glass box with a couple of EPs on vinyl. And they're already out available to buy those albums. And they're charging people, like, $500 for it because, you know, Glassjaw fans are mad. They're absolutely obsessive and mad. So they can just keep re-releasing it in a different box and these mad fuckers will pay for it.
Oh, yeah. So talking of which, so Lee Dorian's Rise Above record shop opened up really close to me in sort of Highgate. I don't live in Highgate. I'm not that posh. But I just know I still haven't visited it yet, but I really want to go in there and just basically look at how expensive all these super rare records that Lee's got in that shop.
Go and have a browse. It's good to browse in your local record shop because we want to keep these things alive. Keep shops alive and records alive.
I did go on a vinyl spree the other day.
Good. Good work. Joe Fleischer asks, if you were returning to a metal and rock festival in the UK or the continent based only on the food, where are we going and what are we eating?
2,000 Trees for me.
What did you eat there?
Well, a myriad of things, but 2,000 Trees source their own, and Arctangent as well, both of them are around, so they source kind of local, they only have like local produce, because it's out in sort of, just out of Bristol, isn't it? It's out in the sort of Somerset area. They get the sort of local cider makers and the local farmed produce and stuff, and their choice of food, there's not one single, like, you know, you get them noodle every festival and the noodle van and everyone gets these, you just, it's the only one that's never got a queue, so you end up going, because I won't queue for more than 4 minutes for anything. So nothing, and there is nothing worth queuing more than 4 minutes for, and so you end up just going, oh well, I'll just buy these, and you get those sloppy noodles with a load of shit chicken or tofu or some crap in it, 9 week old carrots and a bit of, like, you know, frog foot in it, or something horrible. Horrible crap in there, and that's all you get. There's none of that at 2,000 Trees or Arctangent. It's all really good, locally sourced. Local drink, no warm Tuborg, like all the other festivals. I have to queue up for fucking 15 minutes for some student to spill half of your warm Tuborg that's been sitting there in the sun for 4 hours on you and pay £7 for it. It's great. So one of those two, I would say.
Oh, they sound great. How about you, Jonathan?
Good. Well, so my choice it's kind of like slightly tangential, but it would be Inferno Festival in Oslo, obviously Norway, but not for the festival, not for the festival itself, because everything is really expensive, and over there. But there's an official hotel, so they put all the bands and a lot and punters go there, and you get a deal. And, you know, all the kind of media go there. So everyone goes like crazy having noshbills, which is like an after party till 6 in the morning. But then they have a hotel breakfast there, which used to go until midday, which used to be a lifesaver. But my God, it's the best breakfast I've ever had in this hotel. Like, it's a proper Nordic, like, spread of everything you've ever thought of for breakfast and a few things that you haven't. So it would have like a waffle arm. There'd be an omelette chef. They'd have all that kind of... They'd kind of have all that weird sort of Nordic fish. They'd have like caviar even, which I actually really love, is to no surprise. Weird cheeses. And it was just the best spread in the world. And you'd have a difficult decision. Do I go to breakfast before I go to bed at 6 in the morning? Or do I go at 6 in the morning and basically get up and have this amazing breakfast? And hope I get wake up in time to do it, because it's free if you're in the hotel, and if anything's in free in Norway, you do it no matter what. It's just there's a kind of survival
sweets.
Mechanism. You'd probably hate the caviar as well, because that's kind of
salty, savoury food is fine.
Yeah, they have smoked salmon.
Yeah, that's fine.
They have smoked salmon, but I kind of realised that, like, I love it, but I kind of realised that when you're really hungover, you can't really eat anything too slimy, because it just makes you feel really queasy.
You saying the word slimy just makes me feel really queasy.
Well, thanks for that.
Sorry, Joe. then I was just thinking about lots of slimy fish for breakfast and thinking that does not sound like something that I would want to be in.
I'm very
happy for you.
Yeah. Normally, I would just go crazy on free smoked salmon, but it's just you put it on your plate and just like, oh, I can't do this.
You're coming across like you're a penguin on this episode.
Well, mine would be I went to Forterock in 2016 in the Netherlands to see Within Temptation and some other bands, and they had this is not surprising for me. They had this ice cream van, and it had this cart door banana ice cream that was amazing. And I found it one time since on Brighton Pier, because you can't buy it in shops for home consumption. You can only buy it if you're a commercial ice cream vendor. But it's so amazing. It's like the best banana ice cream. And I still think about that banana ice cream like 6 years later. So I'd go back there and have that.
Banana ice cream?
It was amazing.
Does it taste of banana, or does it taste of that weird chemical that I still really like, that everything flavoured of banana actually tastes like, rather than an actual banana?
It tastes like actual banana. It was great.
What? They must put actual bananas in it. That's unheard of. Because normally, everything banana just has that strangely alluring chemical tang to it.
That's great.
As if you like
Midgard's Block Mead, I recommend as well.
Oh, mead. Good one. Who wants to read the next question? Jonathan, do you want to do this one?
Yeah, this is Matt Heeks. He said, if music had a transfer window, who would you like to see bands/artists bring in on loan, either for an album or tour, or who would you like to see bands bring in on a permanent basis?
Mm.
Ooh.
What do you reckon, Steve?
I'd like to, just for the sheer fun of it, I'd like to see a Treu get Tom York from Radiohead in the band, just so that they realise how
careful now.
Bad they were in comparison to an actual real musician.
Ah, I forgot that you have said things about Atreyu before. I forgot that you...
Just on brand, innit? It's on brand.
I forgot that you didn't like them. I was just thinking how mad it would be to get a band like that and then have Tom York in the middle. I was thinking about how
poor
mad
Tom
it would
York.
Be.
Poor
how mad
Tom
it would be. To get any band from our real world, really, and have Tom York in the middle of them. It would only...
Well, I think there are plenty of bands in which you could look at Tom York and Tom York would go in and be like, oh, I can see... If you put Tom York in Mastodon, right, or Between the Buried and Me, or, you know, anyone who have sort of thought about their craft in any way, I think...
Sleep Token.
I don't think Tom York could have a good time in Sleep Token, to be perfectly honest. James, you could put James Arthur in Sleep Token, and I don't think anyone would know the difference. But I think there are a few bands that Tom York would probably go, I'll be in Neurosis for a bit. That sounds like it's a heavier approach to what I usually do sonically, but thematically and approach-wise, I don't think it would be a million miles away from what Radiohead do. But
what you're saying is you want Tom York at Roadburn.
I think that would be amazing, to be fair. Yeah. I think he'd go... Would he go down well, Jonathan, Tom York at Roadburn?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially,
his solo stuff as well, when he does all that kind of electro stuff that he's done. Did the Suspiria soundtrack, didn't he? The remake of Suspiria. That's very kind of dark and gothic-y and blah, blah, blah. Stick him on old Blood Moon with Converge and Chelsea Wolfe and Steve Brodsky and that. That'd be fucking amazing. But not with Atreyu.
Right, that's your final answer then.
Thank you.
Jonathan, how about you?
I just think they should just be an online timpani player.
Timpani.
I think you just add a timpani player to anything, or Kodo drummer, and it would be amazing.
So you just have bands playing, but then on a screen in the background, you just have someone playing the
drums. You bring them on stage. Like,
oh,
I mean,
it was online.
On stage. It would make everything just sound so much more impressive. Can you imagine like blast beating on Kodo drums or on a timpani? It would just sound huge and probably destroy the venue. It would be incredible. And yeah, Kodo drumming is like a super crazy, like train throughout your lifetime art. And
there was somebody who did that, wasn't there, on an album recently? I've gone completely blank. It was someone you wouldn't expect, and they'd brought them in to play Kodo drums, and it was on something we reviewed this year or last year in Metal Hammer. Do you remember what it was?
No, I don't. But I because basically, if you bring a Kodo drum, that's the thing. It might just totally eclipse anything else that they're on, because you'd just be, fuck me, that's a Kodo drummer. I think I have an album of Kodo drummers. I know I've got an album of voodoo, or CD of voodoo drumming, from just various trips to secondhand record shops and just finding weird shit to buy.
I reckon you could have that at Roadburn as well, to be fair.
Yeah, but just imagine how, like, you know, there's a dramatic moment and there's something, boom, like someone hits a timpani. It would just be, you know, maybe get a timpani player with Sun. That'd be amazing.
Mm. Fucking hell. That'd be a long evening.
It would. Yeah, but you need special reinforced venues.
I've cheated on this question, really, because I thought it was really great when Testament brought in Gene Hoagland, because he's such an amazing drummer and he just really lifts the material. And so my cheat code is just get Gene Hoagland with every band, just to see what that sounds like. I think that would be cool.
Think Gene Hoagland would do well in something like the Dixie Chicks?
Why not?
Okay. Mumford and Son with Gene Hoagland on
that
on
would
drums.
Make it infinitely better, Steve. I would go and watch them if he was in it.
Probably would, to be fair. Yeah.
I'd like maybe like a jazz drummer for some dropouts. Like you know, you've got a grindcore band and then suddenly you just drops out and there's a bit of jazz drumming. And then you come back in, go straight back into it. Or jazz drumming to grindcore would be... Jazz grind would be amazing.
There's a black jazz, The Shining. They do black jazz.
Yes, it's not quite. Yes, yeah, not quite the same thing, but it's.
It's really not the same thing. Well, it might, yeah, let's hope it's not. Anyway, because
but I like
that Shining album. Fucking hell! What a load of crap that was.
That was very different. That was very different.
It really is like one of the have you done records.
Yeah, it's bad that one. Fucking hell.
There's a few of those.
Mm. Yeah, they did turn away from black jazz to just smooth. Kind of smooth,
just kind of just total PMA sort of. Yeah. What is this? Like unconvincing PMA. What is this?
Michael Bolton doing Andrew WK. It was basically, wasn't it?
Yeah, not good.
Steve, would you like to take the next question? It's from a Stephen.
It is from a Stephen. Stephen Hornsey. Oh, this is right in my alley. This is right of all of our alleys, isn't it? What bands would you pick to write the next generation of WWE entrance themes? You lot on your fucking wrestling.
I should have said Merlin's on holiday this week.
You should really have said. Or just not pick that question. I don't know. The next generation? I mean, the last time I paid any attention to the wrestling, really, was probably when... the British Bulldog lost the Intercontinental title to Shawn Michaels in 1992. So it's a little while ago. So I'm not really familiar with the general feeling and aesthetic and vibe of current world wrestling entertainment. But what bands would I like to see playing to lots of people, basically, innit?
Because they've had Code Orange recently, haven't they? Mm-hmm. Like, that was a big deal, so... I was sort of thinking around that area, and like, obviously I've mentioned my favourite... sort of contemporary band right now is Spirit Box, so I just get them to do it. Did you have a pick, Steve? Is there someone that you would pick?
What, for wrestling? I don't know. I just think... I don't know. I wouldn't... Jonathan, I'm thinking about it. Jonathan, do you
have Yeah. Anything? Well, first of all, I was going to say, would Spirit Box go with wrestling? Because they're kind of sort of emotional. It's just like... I don't know.
Yes,
so,
I think they would, yes.
So... I don't know about the, like, I don't really get, I'm not one of those people who gets to WWE. I kind of grew up in the era of, like, John Haystacks, Mick McManus, and
Big Daddy.
And Big Daddy, yeah. I once actually got put in a headlock by Big Daddy, which is we were at a school trip to Crystal Palace, the sort of sportsy thing they had down there back in the day. And Shirley Crabtree, that was his real name. Was there, and we took pictures of me being in a headlock by not Big Daddy. Who's the other one?
Giant Haystacks.
It was Big Daddy. And Jonathan, my God, he's got a grip. And he had a total like Like, there's no way you're getting out of that. That guy's a proper pro. And I remember, like, so I like the sort of, like, the kind of slightly more mundane world of sport, drizzly Saturday afternoon on ITV kind of wrestling myself. But, so, I don't know about the next generation of WWE things, but what I would like to see as a WWE wrestler, just for complete change of pace, is have this really existential wrestler who really wants to get beaten down, like a masochistic wrestler, and I'd have him coming out to Godflesh, which is all about kind of being beaten down by the world. So just this wrestler always gets beaten and hit, and he thinks he deserves it, and it's like the universe telling him something. So yeah, I'd have an existential wrestler coming out to Godflesh.
Stephen Hornsey, I'm so sorry. You just wanted a proper answer to your question. Do you know what? We'll get a mail in to answer this question next time there's another podcast with Rina Urinosin.
Yeah, but something off the street, because it sounds like, you know, it sounds like the universe just forming a massive fist and punching you again and again.
Trivium. That's
Trivium?
A sensible suggestion. Sensible. Yeah.
The new Trivium album's really great. So Trivium.
Good try, Steve. Good try. Scott Sitample asks, what's the most metal condiment? Jonathan.
This question gives me the fear, and I'll tell you why. Naming no names, but back in the days of Bloodstock, where everyone was just doing video stuff backstage with bands and asking really stupid question, one poor sod was charged with going up, with interviewing Eric Danielson from Watain and asking him, you're at Bloodstock, what stock do you like cooking with?
Oh.
Yeah, that did not end particularly well. And that's my comment on that question.
Right then. So you think stock's the most metal condiment?
No, I don't know.
It's not a condiment. That's not a condiment. Stock.
No, it's more of a cooking ingredient.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I just put chili all over everything.
Well, yeah, I was actually going to say, surely chili oil is the and hot sauce are the most metal condiments.
Yeah,
not everything's metal, is it? Do you know what I mean? Not every single thing in the world has got some tie to metal. Do you know what I mean? What's the most metal floorboard? Oh, not everything has got to be linked to. You're allowed to live your life without everything relating back to metal. You do know that.
But it's more fun if it is.
Exactly. I was going to say that.
You know, like, I stand by Nathan from Metalocalypse. Like, we make coffee metal. We make everything metal. I'm not going to do his voice.
I'm not going to not have mayonnaise because it's not as metal as, like, HP sauce. Do you know what I mean?
There's a lot of bands, though, that have their own hot sauces, which is why I think hot sauce is a really safe bet for a metal condiment, because it's strong and powerful and makes you contort your face into weird shapes, and that's what metal does.
I've got the Employed to Serve and Paradise Lost chili sauce, actually.
There you go. So just take back everything you said in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, I get massive.
Not going to do that, but including the Trivium for, because that's about 5 minutes ago. Trivium for
Steve.
WWE. Go on. Yes.
Stop misbehaving.
All right. Shall we?
Daniel Plytus has a question. He says, in spite of Latin America being a huge market for metal, why do you think Spanish-speaking bands haven't had the same international success as their counterparts from Europe, Japan, and even Mongolia?
I think there's a reason for this, because most Latin American bands are probably underground, and there's a reason there's a really strong underground is because they come from like really specific, political and social situations, and.
Yeah.
And so that's where you get this kind of really raw, like, sandy metal from Colombia and Brazil and bands like Mr. Fire and Sarcophago. And, you know, that's not going to necessarily translate to a wider market. But as far as, like, extreme metal fans go, you know, South America is kind of a bit of a metal sort of hot, is a really metal hotspot. And it's really go for, like, you know, really true underground metal for people who use the word satanist without any irony whatsoever and just completely fucking go for it without any self-consciousness at all. So I love that dirty, filthy South American death and black metal sound. But
I was I agree with you. It's so diverse, isn't it? Every like country has their own political, social, musical climate. And actually, if you go on our website, metalhammer.com, there are a few features about some documentaries that have been made about Latin America by a man called Nelson Varas Diaz. And he's done loads and loads of stuff. The Metal Islands and some other ones, all about metal in Latin America, and really kind of gets into like all those different scenes. Whereas, yeah, I think bands from Japan and Mongolia, it's sort of easier for people to wrap their head around the context. And those bands are probably pushed a little bit more because...
I think it's also worth saying that I don't think Latin music in general has a huge reach into kind of more white westernized popular. I mean, when you look at a band the size of somebody like Los Lobos, who are absolutely huge, they haven't really got a sort of a mainstream crossover success in the same way as a lot of bands similarly would have. You know, I mean, there is that kind of, people have to want to kind of go into Latin music as its own thing. I'm not sure how much it usually crosses over, kind of in the same way that metal in general does. I mean, even when you look at the bands who, when you think of that kind of the biggest names in that kind of Latino metal, Latin metal, like, I don't know what they, you know, that kind of, when Sepultura came out, it was like the Welcome to the Third World and all that stuff. Obviously, Sepultura sung in English. You've got bands like El Nino back in the day, or Puya. I actually really like Puya, and they lean very heavily on that kind of flamenco salsa thing in a new metal framework, but mostly sung in English, I guess, just to kind of make them more palatable for that audience.
Yeah,
and I feel like that's kind of obviously with bands from Japan and Mongolia and different parts of the world, that's obviously breaking down, and India and things, that's breaking down a little bit more now. But back then, I think it was like when those bands were kind of first coming out, it's a really, really difficult thing to really get to cross over to just the biggest market in music, and the biggest market in music is kind of white people, I think.
It's probably rap, but also we don't really know how pervasive South American music is in the US, for instance. I'm sure it's much more pervasive than it is, because there's such a crossover in cultures there. But also, I just think, you know, a lot of the traditional musics in South America, having just said that American metal is really sort of dark and filthy and grimy, a lot of traditional music is way too upbeat and uplifting, you know, and sort of, you know, wanting this kind of good life to be really sort of fit really well into a metal framework, where you don't have that kind of sadness that you get, or yet yearning, or that longing that you get in kind of Mongolian music, would fit that well into a metal framework.
Yeah, but I do think possibly. I think the thing about America having, you know, would it be bigger? It probably is bigger in America, but they almost have their own charts. I mean, like over here, there's a whole underground of like reggae music and dub music, which, you know, there are artists that can fill out Brixton Academy, 5,000 capacity, that would never cross over to a kind of white pop audience. And
in the same way that metal bands can fill the Astoria and not cross over into an audience.
Yeah, in the same way. Yeah, in the same way. But I think that's probably something that, you know, every kind of, I guess, ghettoized style of music, because pop music is always going to be in the general mainstream media. That's always going to be the thing that people are mostly made aware of.
Yeah,
but
there was, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, you know, rock and metal was so much more sort of close to the mainstream. You know, I used to see Maiden
on top of
the Pops. I used to see The Cult on top of the Pops, Bauhaus on top of the Pops, Japan on top. Okay, that was one metal band. But, you know, but slightly more left-field bands. You know, Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson was number two, which is like a ridiculously avant-garde song, and it got to number two in the charts. And it's just, like I was saying earlier on, that stuff has kind of like slipped out of any kind of popular cultural discourse. Which I, you know, It's kind of sad, but
yeah,
it's understandable.
It is sort of understandable. I think it's like it's a different thing, though, isn't it? To like, there's no cultural identity in the, for rock music. Like Motley Crue or a metal band in the same way as Amoebics were a metal band, if you're going to be as broad about it as that. But
yeah,
but reggae, for example, is very, very definitely culturally born of a place and would be happy to kind of... There are a lot of artists in that world who are like, I'm happy to just exist inside my and our little sort of community and society and don't even try and push themselves to... You know, that a broader audience, and maybe there's, I don't know. I mean, I used to think you would see Latin based pop artists in the shops in HMV or whatever. You'd go into their CDs, and even though they're essentially making a similar sort of music to somebody like, TLC or whatever, they're in the Latin jazz pop section as opposed to the rock and pop section. So there's an obvious, there's a kind of a gap between those two things. There's a deliberate like kind of thing placed in between those two things just because of the geography and the language in which it was sung.
Yeah. So there's a lot of pop, like Latin American pop hits. Remember Mammy Sound Machine? Yeah, Gloria Estefan and Mammy Sound Machine. Dr. Beat.
Yeah. You know. But it's like it's a very brief mainstream fascination in something.
Yeah. Which but we're getting very far off metal now.
We are, yeah, sorry, go on.
Well, if you do want to know more about metal in Latin America, the last film that Nelson made was called Acts of Resistance, and there's a feature all about it on metalhammer.com, and you can click through there and you can actually watch it as well and learn all about the different scenes that he's covered there and Latin American metal. Yeah.
As well as my feature, Mystifier, from Brazil. Which is also on
metalhammer.com. Oh, yeah! Read that as well. We got a couple more questions, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
We've got one from Peter Stones. He says, I went to download for years and years. However, I'm finding it more and more that Bloodstock caters to my likes. I'm not a power metal fan or even a fan of bands like Judas Priest. Just looking next year with Lamb of God, Black Dahlia, Bury Tomorrow and Static X, I'm already considering Bloodstock next year. Am I the only middle-aged metalhead who feels like this? Am I mellowing? Am I stuck in my ways? Or are the festivals changing? So Peter's basically saying he thinks he's more of a Bloodstock guy than a Download guy now. Is it just him? What is happening?
I mean, if you're 41, you're probably more likely to be a Bloodstock than a Download guy these days, or Download person these days, I imagine.
Well, Download, the last Download we had, Download Pilot, was pretty young, wasn't it? It was an all British lineup, and yeah, all coming from the UK and young up and coming bands. So if we're comparing like Download Pilot to Bloodstock this year, that's a huge difference. But comparing Download to Bloodstock on a normal year, there's still a lot of what you'd say is called legacy bands at Download Festival. They've got loads of those on the bill next year for 2022. They've got like Kiss headlining, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you can't get more legacy than that.
Well, I'm the same age. I'm also 41, so I'm the same age as Peter. And I would probably agree with what he's just said. I mean, I definitely don't think he's mellowing, because he'd rather go and watch Lamb of God than, you know, A Day to Remember or whoever's playing Download next year. But I think I get why. I think the spread of eras and ages from Download is probably a bit wider in general, I guess, because Bloodstock does tend to focus on, you know, like Kiss are a 70s band, and there are lots of bands who are kind of cosplaying that kind of 70s rock thing on the main stages at Download, that kind of classic rock, leather waistcoat-y, Stetson-wearing stuff, which I'm not into at all. There's a lot of bands that are either from that era or are trying to do that era, that kind of temperance movement, you know, Rival Sons, classic rock revival thing that's going on, you know, Greta Van Fleet, all that stuff. that's not really something that I'm interested in at all. I'm also not interested in, like I say, a Day to Remember or any of the more sort of modern pop punk bands that they put on. Whereas Bloodstock, I think they do a really good job of honing in on heavy metal from the 80s and a good spread of the more extreme artists from now, who are probably, you can see the joins and the through line throughout the whole lineup, I think, far more clearly than you maybe can with Download, which is, you know, 4 stages over 3 days and trying to cater for every single person that has ever been interested in some kind of guitar music in some way. And that's a really hard thing to do, to give them credit.
I'd say there's loads and loads and loads of metal at Download, but Bloodstock is focused only on metal, and I think that's always been the case. Download is focused on metal and other heavy music types. Like, if you look at the Download poster, you've got Kiss, Iron Maiden, they're headlining the main stage, and then other headliners of other stages, you've got Megadeth, Electric Wizard, and Sepultura. Like, they're all like proper metal bands, and they're headlining stages. So you can't say that Download isn't metal. But they've also got, like you said, they've got A Day to Remember sub-headlining under Kiss. They've got Biffy Clyro, obviously, on the Sunday, who you wouldn't class as a metal band. And they've got a ton of other, like, younger bands on the smaller stages, like Boston Manor. You know, they've got... Who else they got? See, now I'm looking for newer bands, and all I'm seeing is Obituary and Dying Fetus. I'm like, oh, there's more metal. But it's just... It's traditionally just been broader, hasn't it? It's just been a broader range of things, whereas Bloodstock is, you know, metal.
So here's the thing, like Obituary, Electric Wizard, they're bands I'd actually expect more to see at Bloodstock. And Black Dahlia, Bury Tomorrow, Static X are bands I'd more expect to see at Download. So I think that the axes are shifting a little bit, and, you know, people were wondering even... Our Parkway Driver Bloodstock band, but it just shows where Bloodstock's kind of axis is kind of shifting, kind of slightly much more towards a younger audience maybe, or towards, I don't know if you could call it kind of more mainstream, but less away, but further away from the more extreme 80s side of things. Like you tend to get like no more than on the, you know, unless you're talking about the new Blood stage at Bloodstock, you don't get very many black or death metal bands at Bloodstock these days. Although, you know, bear in mind, Bloodstock started out as an indoor power metal festival, so you know that, and that's still part of its legacy. But I feel that Bloodstock is kind of moving away from the more extreme end of things, which is what you go to Bloodstock for. But then you have other festivals like Damnation who are representing that. So
yeah,
I think there's a lot of kind of cross hatching between Bloodstock and Download these days about what the identities are.
I mean, just looking at the Bloodstock lineup here: Testament, Exodus, Kuar, Merciful Fate, Dimmu Borgir, Sacred Reich, Black Dahlia Murder, Violence. I mean, it's still I Hate God, Discharge, Enforced. Like, you know, I think the majority of it, you could look at something like, I mean, if you want to be really kind of super kind of pure metal about it, you could, I know there were people when Lamb of God played it in 2014 going, Lamb of God are too groovy, but that's kind of mental. But I mean, if you wanted to be, you know, Buried Tomorrow, yeah. Ginger, Hatebreed, Static X, Sleep Token. There's not a lot else I can see on here that A Life of Agony, like Butcher Babies, maybe, yeah. But there's not a lot. I mean, it still feels pretty.
It's always a mix, you know. I guess.
And I'm sure they will. Like, you know, they haven't announced the Friday headliner yet, and I would imagine that will be a sort of looking at it. Maybe they'll get some sort of power metal-y headliner, because that appears to be the thing that they're missing a little bit. They've got a kind of legacy act, and they've got a kind of newer groove, I get one for the more mainstream metal fans in Lamb of God. They could do with maybe a Within Temptation or a Sabaton or something like that headlining that first day, and I think it would be a really good shout for them, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean that kind of sort of jolly stuff has always been part of Bloodstock. You know, and I was super happy that, I know it's under specific circumstances, but that create, like, where else would in the UK would create have got a headline slot, where they totally justified that headline slot. Like, it's probably one of my sets in the entire festival at Bloodstock this year.
Whenever we have these conversations about Bloodstock and Download, it always kind of just ends up going, isn't it really good to have two massive metal festivals in the UK? Isn't that awesome? Like, they're both good, aren't they?
And, you know, and, nice, you know, thing. Yeah, and if you want sort of, you know, the other end of things, we have other festivals. We have, like, Damnation, Incineration, and Desert Fest as well. So, you know, we're well catered for. They're just, it's just, I find English festivals are very... English outdoor festivals are kind of different from continental metal festivals, where they can have, they're just bands that will play there. Like, I'm still surprised Solstafir have never played a UK outdoor festival.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's quite interesting. I mean, again, to kind of go back to the initial point, there are more bands playing the main stage on the Sunday at Bloodstock that I want to see. And that is just a Sunday. It's not been completely announced yet. Than there are playing on the entirety of all 3 days on the main stage at Download.
Wow.
So there's four bands I want to see on the Sunday already at Bloodstock. There's three bands across the entire weekend on the main stage I want to see at Download.
I think that level would definitely be higher for me. I've not counted, but yeah, I mean, obviously, like, Deftones are going to be amazing. So yeah. All good. Festivals are changing and we are changing at the same time. Probably the answer to that.
Maybe.
Maybe. We've got one final question. Do you want to ask Steve? And then Jonathan, I believe, will answer this question.
I do. Alistair Belling says, in the event of Jonathan being on the episode, he is, would love to hear his story of giving Cold by Cold a donut back in the day and getting the sack, if that's true. Just before I go on for the rest of the question, I have said review in front of me here, and I will be happy to read it in its entirety if you would request that to happen. In the event that he's not on the podcast, would love to know what you find harder to write, a 10 out of 10 or a 1 out of 10. I've landed a new job at a newspaper, congratulations, in Australia, and I have 160 words to justify why I think the new Tom Morello album is sonic filth, deserving of a 1 for my trial review. Really tricky to get right, writing-wise. Jonathan, I feel that I may have leaked this story to a couple of people because I found this Cold review, and I think maybe I put it on Twitter and you said something about, oh, that nearly got me sacked, and this might have been how this has cropped up.
Yeah, but yeah.
I do have the February 1998 issue of Metal Hammer right here, and it has got your review of the record Cold by Cold, which I actually bought, and you gave 0 out of 10. And it's here.
Well deserved. Well deserved 0 out of 10. Deserves nothing more.
Do you want me to read it?
How long is it, Steve?
It's a box out, basically.
Oh, you can probably run through that then.
Cold by Cold. Yeah, this has got to stop. Grunge's glory days are so far behind us now that it's pointless to even feel nostalgic anymore. But still they come, a succession of witless, by the book, post-grunge alt-rockers, each one proving yet again that Nirvana, destructed in vain, and all of whom seem to think that claiming your Generation X credentials will make your pretty heavy-handed navel-gazing magic resonant. Cold's debut LP isn't just a case in point, it's a new, if grimly predictable, low. A record so transparently obvious that it has to set the standard to which all other bands stoop. This isn't because Cold are technically awful, it's because they try so damn hard. A record all about ennui shouldn't take this much effort, but listen to Scooter Ward's unnaturally labelled vocals, his nasal granite choked rasp that sounds like he's trying to sing and hold his breath at the same time, and you'll hear the desperate sound straining for authenticity, even though he's little more than a karaoke combination of Gavin Rossdale and Eddie Vedder. Cold cite The Cure as an influence, and it shows. Cold itself is shot through with the same dispirited, drawn-out guitar refrains, a miserable attempt to gain some kind of epic stature, like they expect us all to sink into the mire together. In fact, the only unprecedented aspect of this album is its unremitting dullness, because despite its stadium-pitched miserabilism, Cold details just how far grunge had atrophied from rage to sullen attempts at self-justification, from spurred insatiability to debilitating attempts to prove yourself real, as though a hideously stilted delivery were all it took. Even though Cold typify grunge's retreat into narcissism, their worst travesty lies in their assumption that they share a common ground. Cold, these guys are fucking frigid. 0 out of 10. Very good, Jonathan. Very good.
Fair that is a diatribe.
So one of our writers, Joe Daly, commented on that. He says, I basically took a hatchet to everything within 100 miles of that record, or 10 miles of that record. So yeah, I need to give
a... You've been a huge influence on me, by the way, Jonathan. You're a huge influence on my writing. And I'm glad to put that kind of passion that you felt towards Cold, a record that I bought, towards modern music.
I guess I was a little bit triggered, but I need to provide a little bit of context for this review. So, in the 90s, I was writing for Melody Maker, which wasn't a metal magazine. We covered metal, but you know, it wasn't really a metal magazine. But it was a very different culture from what Metal Hammer was at the time. You know, it was a very different worldview. It was much more, whereas metal was always seen about authenticity. The Maker sort of discourse was kind of all about playfulness and reinventing yourself, and also, you know, it had really kind of like personality writers, like people who had a particular style of writing that was particular only to them. You know, we could use first person because we knew how to use first person back then, i.e. not as a qualifier to say I think this, I think that, but as a prism, you know, to kind of like shine everything through and go off on some weird tangent that would actually shed some other new light on the thing you were writing about. So it was much more kind of personality based. It was much more, yeah, we could be pretty nasty about records. It was just really kind of attention grabbing stuff. And I guess that was a very different culture from what the metal press was like back then, which is probably a lot more worthy. But that's exactly why I got asked to write for Metal Hammer by the then deputy editor. You know, he wanted like me to shake things up a little bit, and I did. You know, because I come from a very different, I think a slightly more vivid kind of writing style. So, you know, but I got to do amazing things from back in the 90s. You know, I got late 90s. I got, you know, my first piece was on Korn, and I got to travel to New York to interview Marilyn Manson. And, yeah, so I think people had different ideas of what I was there for. So, you know, on one hand, I was there for to shake things up a little bit. On the other hand, well, not quite that much. But if you let me loose, I'm just going to let loose. And I was always trying to see what I could get away with within the certain, like, how I can push the boundaries of what, you know, I was always aware of what magazine I was writing for. And, so Cold, that record completely triggered me. Totally. It was everything I hated. And I literally could not find a single redeeming feature in that record.
Did you get the sack?
Let's just say that the writing, the commissions completely dried up after that. And when I saw the editor, that person said at the time, well, I said, you know, you haven't asked me to do anything. I'm still really want to write for you. And this person said, I don't really think you're into metal, which is...
Because you don't like Cold.
Yeah. Which is kind of ironic, since I then ended up at the next time I saw this person, I was at the I was as editor of Terrorizer, the extreme metal magazine. But no one really gets the sack from as a freelancer. You just don't get commissions anymore, and yeah, that pretty much happened. But it just triggered everything. I hate this kind of self pity. I hate this kind of like that American sort of earnest honking like sound, and it's just everything about it was so contrived, and I really hate people claiming emotions that aren't really theirs, and just everything about that, it's just everything I hated in music, and I just thought, right, I'm going to go to town on it. And to answer the other part of this question, yeah, if you're going to give something a 1 or 0 out of 10, you've got to word it really carefully. You can't just take you can't just go into the blunderbuss. You've got to be really specific about what's wrong with them. And if you just take them down really thoroughly, you've got less comeback. But so I'm much more thorough if I, you know, I don't really review records these days for various reasons, but if I'm going to slag a band off, I've got to know exact. I've got to let people know exactly why I think they're wrong and be really thorough with it. And that's kind of what I was.
It was very thorough. Steve, any final thoughts about Jonathan's review or writing something that's a 0 out of 10?
Yeah, well, I've just looked, and I think what I would say in terms of like putting it in a, because you would be called a bad music journalist for writing that in 2021. You would be called that. Would people would say you're bad at your job because what you've done is you've done exactly what the remit was, is you've reviewed it and you've given your kind of opinion on it. But actually, I think what people think nowadays is that you just, our reviews are meant to just be being nice to things. And what I would say to those people is that, you know, going back to Lester Bangs and Robert Christgau, like they're the entire purpose of critique and criticism and music journalism is to do that, is to critique music. And if everything's good, kind of nothing is. Do you know what I mean? So you need to have, you need to kind of be able to write those things now and again. And I wouldn't want to, like a debut album from a band. I mean, they're on A&R, like they were signed by Fred Durst Cold. They were getting pushed quite heavily, so I kind of feel like they're fair game. If it's some band who are unsigned and it's their demo, you know, giving them a real kick in feels like a bit of a sort of nasty thing to do. But if
it was a big box review, so it wasn't like I was like, you know, kicking a small band.
No, not at all. But I think, you know, like Cold's music is still on Spotify. They carried on touring. They released other records after that. It didn't destroy their career. I think, you know, a negative review, you might not like it or might not agree with it, but I think, you know, you either trust the institution or the person that you are seeing the review from, or you don't. And if you don't, it's all right. You go, well, I don't. I mean, I used to see loads of reviews in the NME back in the 90s, and I'd just go, well, I'm just not going to buy the NME because I don't agree with, like, pretty much anything they say. But I do think it's important to be able to give something that you feel has very, very little artistic worth.
But also,
kind of review.
Yeah, but also I wasn't just like shitting on them. I was just saying that, you know, I was trying to explain that, you know, I have ideals that I think these people are like diluting. So it was something that was kind of very important to me to articulate. Because, and it wasn't just to say, oh, well, you're shit, I'm great. It was to say that we need to hold on to what these ideals originally stood for, and people are diluting those ideals. So I wasn't taking glee in it. I was just really thorough. And also, you know, my mentor, the guy who made me want to be a music journalist, was a guy called Simon Reynolds. And, you know, he always used to say that music journalism should not be an auxiliary arm of the PR industry. And you know, to whatever extent you're kind of I hate to use this word, but you're kind of a gatekeeper, but only because you're going to hear it first, and hopefully you've got kind of a way with words to articulate something. And you know, but back then, you know, music journalism always came from a perspective, you know, and you had to trust the perspective of that writer, because we're all kind of, in our own way, agitating for something as journalists and as, you know, as people who love music and culture. And so we've all got our own thing that we're kind of agitating for, and our own worldview that we want to get across, and that we like to, and we get super thrilled when we find some aspect of it reflected in a piece of music or piece of art or something. So it's not, you know, it's something about how you see the world. And So I still think that, you know, music journalism is still an important thing. It's important for me to be able to articulate my view of the world. It's important for me to kind of get part of that, hopefully, to other people to see how I see the world. And maybe you'll see the record in a different way, whether it's, you'll see something more in it than you did. But that's why I don't think music journalism is necessarily parasitic. Like, you have to have something to give.
There's always the thing as well about how, as Oscar Wilde said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. And I've actually never listened to that Cold record. And having heard it being so eloquently savaged, I now must go and listen to it and hear what it was that was triggering you so badly, Jonathan, and why you had to write a review.
My band used to cover one of their songs. My band actually used to cover one of the songs from that record. And we read that review. We were like, oh. And I don't remember being like, I remember going like, ha, that's pretty funny. And being like, I don't think it's not that bad. But I didn't get upset about it. I think if you do get upset by a review, you're a massive wanker and a big baby. But, you know, that's just what I think.
Good. Okay. That's all we have time for. Thank you, everybody, for your reader questions. You can find the Metal Hammer Readers Group on Facebook. Go and join and have some lovely chats with us and other people who are into metal. We will be back next week with another podcast. And for now, it's goodbye. Goodbye, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye.